Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. People who have regrown fingertips and regained leg muscles lost to explosions. A woman who lost her sight in an industrial accident can now see with her ears. A military commander at the Pentagon who's behind an ambitious new effort to reverse engineer human intuition. Researchers who are developing a sort of Viagra for the brain that could offer extraordinary powers of memory. These stories are all featured in The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human, by award-winning investigative journalist and science writer Adam Piori. Adam is a former editor and correspondent for Newsweek. He joins us this hour by phone. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
Very good. So good you could join us for the entire hour. We want to invite our listeners to join us this hour, especially those who are perhaps disabled and find that technology has made once impossible things possible, lifted those limitations by whatever disability you have. That's a lot of what we'll be talking about this hour. If you'd like to join us with a question or perhaps your experience, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Adam, your book is full of fascinating stories about people who are working to reverse engineer, to rebuild, or somehow add to augment humans. Before we get into some of those stories, tell us in your words, what ties all of these stories together?
The overall idea, the thing that I've followed throughout my career and that's always fascinated me is human resilience, you know, just the ability of people to bounce back from adversity. And, you know, I lived in Cambodia for a while, which was recovering from a genocide, and I covered New York in post 9/11 as people were bouncing back. And so I've always been fascinated by psychological resilience. But, what I found was just quite by accident is that some of the most exciting stories of human resilience in the United States are being unleashed by technology. And what ties all these things together is that, a couple things, but one is that our sensing technologies, our ability to, you know, take apart what's going on in the human body and mind on the molecular level has increased so much in recent years, and our computational power to sort of analyze how all the different parts of the body and mind fit together has increased. And then our ability to kind of hack into these systems and tweak them, using technology has also expanded. So, you know, with bionics, we're talking about looking at how constituent parts of the arm or leg move together and using motion capture technologies to see how they move together and then building robotic parts that replace the parts that are missing. When you're talking about pharmacology, like you mentioned Viagra for the brain, small molecules, you're looking at how molecular level pathways work in the brain or the body and trying to find ways to do that. But, you know, in the last century, the best engineers were building bridges, getting us to the moon, building cars and skyscrapers. And now we have some of the best engineers are turning their sights inward to see how the body and mind work. And really, we just didn't have the computational power to tease it apart at the level we can right now. So that's what ties it all together, pretty much.
You've divided your book, Adam, into three different themes, moving, sensing, and thinking. Let's start with moving and have you tell us the story of Hugh Hare, a really amazing rock climber as a young man, got into some real trouble in a wilderness area. Tell us his story.
Sure, yeah. So this is a book about science, but I wanted to understand how things work and what's possible and explain that to people who might not be scientists. But really, you know, I just love telling stories. I love human drama. I love, narratives, getting lost in a story, escapist cinematic type things. And this Hugh Hare story was, you know, really a mind-blowing great yarn that was and his story was he was this champion rock climber, one of the best on the East Coast. I think around the age of 16 and 17, he'd already conquered, climbed some rock faces that nobody else had climbed and was already known around the country. But he was a mediocre student. He didn't I think he didn't. He later said he didn't even understand what fractions were. And you know, C and D student, thought about rock climbing all the time. Very motivated there. One break he traveled to New Hampshire to Mount Washington with a friend of his, and it was winter, and they went ice climbing, and then they were going to climb to the top of Mount Washington. And so they hiked in and they climbed up this ice wall, and the storm was just starting when they started out, but by the time they got up there to the top and tried to start climbing the mountain, the storm had really picked up. There was, I think, 50 or 60 mile an hour winds. There was no visibility. And all of a sudden, they realized they were in trouble and they needed to turn around and go back. But they couldn't see anything because the wind had shifted. And so they followed, because there was so much snow in front of them, they followed the wind to go back the way they came, but you know they didn't know the direction of the wind was different, and they walked into a wilderness area and they got lost, and they wandered for a couple days, and eventually Hugh Hurst stepped into a frozen lake, a frozen stream. His socks got all icy, and eventually they just lay under a rock and waited to die. And they were on their last legs basically when somebody wandered upon them and save their lives. But, you know, they had frostbite, and Hugh Hurst's legs were amputated below the knees. And the doctors told him he would never walk or run again. And he would dream at night. He would wake up dreaming that he was running through the cornfield behind his parents' house. And then he'd notice that his legs were gone and he would never run again. But, you know, he didn't give up, and he tried rock climbing again. And he found that he was actually lighter and he could still do it. So he began tinkering with his prosthetics. He made them 10 feet long so he could reach different handholds that he couldn't reach before. He made tiny little prosthetics with blades that could go into crevices. And he became an even better rock climber than he was before.
And it's really amazing what he came up with. You can see it on your website, Adam, that he really... What was his strength? Sort of thinking out of the box, and instead of trying to, I think you describe how he got an early prosthetic that was just like this clunk of, you know, that looked like a lower leg, but didn't really function. And what was it when he started thinking, well, what does the leg actually do here, that he could think outside the box?
Right. So, yeah, he just started experimenting with forms and shapes. And then when he was walking down on the ground, it just wasn't satisfying. Right. He had basically the same kind of peg leg that they've been giving the Civil War soldiers 100 years before. And he began tinkering with that, and he began taking classes. And soon he was a straight A student, and he got into MIT. And now he's the leading prosthetics engineer and designer in the world, one of them. And what he found, you know, when he pursued these studies and what I talked about in the book, and this is what's allowing this thing, is over the recent years, people have discovered that the leg is actually, it's this complex web of springs that do a remarkable job of just, they capture, juggle, and recycle energy. So every time we take a step, we're recycling about 50% of the energy from our previous step. So if you just have a peg leg, you know, it's not doing the trick, right? I mean, it's like a dead weight on your leg. That's why people have back problems. That's why people have eccentric gaits. And so Hugh Herr began using, once he was at MIT, he began using these motion capture technologies to decode the way that all the constituent parts of the leg fit together, and how they react, and how they absorb and juggle energy. And if you think about it, you know, these motion capture technologies that are used in, like you see them on TV for EA Sports or for the movie Avatar, they're these tiny little shiny balls that track different parts of the leg. And, you know, it would have been impossible to see. There's a few hundred parts of the leg, a few hundred ligaments, tendons, muscles, and bones that move in relation to each other. You know, if you move your foot or leg around right now in front of you, you can see how it moves. Mm-hmm. They move in relation to each other to juggle energy. And we didn't have the capacity to measure all of them and see how they would affect each other in every single possible movement until recently. And so using motion capture, Hugh Herr was able to come up with a computation, you know, an algorithm describing how they interact, and put that on a computer chip, and then build a robotic parts that can do the same thing as the real human leg. And it feels so real that when people put it on, they often start to cry. And Hugh Herr, by the way, I was saying that he would dream of running through the field behind his parents' house, and doctor said he'd never run again. He jogs every day around Walden Pond now on prosthetic limbs, and he loves it.
Amazing.
And I couldn't even tell that he's wearing them, really. I mean,
listening to just a few, we don't have time for all of them. There's so many amazing stories of people who've lost some ability. In this case, Hugh Hare, his legs were gone from a wilderness accident, but there are other aspects of people being limited by accidents and so forth. Adam Peery is with us, if you've just joined us, author of The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Just to finish up with Hugh Hare, he is now at MIT. This is really amazing. A mediocre student becomes a leading prosthetics engineer at MIT because of this accident. This wander into the wilderness. But now he's also, you describe in the book, working with others to develop a new kind of amputation surgery.
Right, yeah. This happened after the book. But, well, I mean, some of it had been conceptually possible before the book, but they now have their first patient. And it's you know, there's a guy who, he actually was friends with Hugh Hare back in the day. He remembered, he even roomed with him long before Hugh got to MIT, when he was, you know, starting out climbing with these strange-shaped prosthetics. And he had a rock climbing accident, and he became the first volunteer to undergo an amputation. They've developed it with Mass General. And basically, you know, still the limitation of these limbs, even though they move like the real thing, they're not connected directly to the nervous system. So there's no ability to get the sensory feedback from touch. And also, you know, you can't stand on your tiptoes. You know, you can put pressure down, and then the leg and foot will respond the way your foot would and get signals that way. But you don't have as much control. So what they've done is they amputated this guy's leg, and they left a little flap of muscle that can be integrated into the limb. And they can detect signals coming out of the muscle and use that to move different parts of the limb. Mm. So that's under experimentation right now. Some other researchers have found ways to connect prosthetics directly to the brain, to the brain's motor cortex. For example, quadriplegics, right, who can't move at all. The signals from the brain are still there when you think about moving. When they think about moving their arm or their leg, their brain is still moving the arm and the leg. That just the spinal cord is severed, so there's no way to get that signal to the arm and the leg. Well, if you could put electrodes that can sense those signals, telling where the person's telling the arm and the leg to move, you can transmit them wirelessly to these prosthetics. And you can have them move.
So making a detour, so to speak, around the nervous system, which is blocked.
Yeah.
And how far are we away from these sort of thought controlled limbs being developed?
Well, so they've actually used them in the lab. There's a woman who is a quadriplegic who is able to actually drink chocolate milk using a prosthetic arm, right? Just using her brain to control it. And they've had monkeys. They even had monkeys. Where they can be more invasive, control robots jogging on treadmills, you know, just by thinking. And so it's possible. The thing is that, you know, the level, like when you, so you can get a signal out of the brain, a crude signal from the motor cortex using the current technology. But if you really want to replicate the way it really is, you need to record from a lot more neurons than we currently are capable of recording from. And Obama's Brain Initiative is funding. They're trying to develop new ways. They just recently awarded about $60 million in grants to a bunch of different consortiums that are trying to find a way to record from maybe a million neurons. So they can do it in the lab. But as one guy said to me, like, if you wanted to control a thought-controlled wheelchair or something, it's not something you would want to drive in traffic right now around the edge of a cliff, you know, but you could do it in the lab, but it's not yet ready for everyday use.
Well, when we take it one step further from prosthetics to people who have lost, you know, parts of their bodies, and then there is a lot of movement in this, what is called regenerative medicine. Give us an example of how that's being used today. Where is the cutting edge?
Right, so Hugh Hare is looking at, he's reverse engineering, he's measuring reverse engineering how the constituent parts of the leg or arm move together, and then he's building, you know, robotic parts that can do what those parts that are missing do. What regenerative medicine people are doing is they're looking at, they're going a step further. They're going into our cells and looking at the signals that actually tell the body to rebuild something, you know, to regenerate. And that's, you hear a lot about stem cells, right? And so there's people are learning how to harness stem cells. I mean, and it's relatively recent that we've discovered what stem cells are and how they work. And, you know, a stem cell is basically, they call it a stem cell because it's sort of like the stem of a flower, right? It can grow into any number of things. And stem cells, what they've discovered in recent years is they respond to the signals in their environment. So, you know, they respond to what's around them in the body. They respond to sort of chemical and molecular level signals that come, but they also respond to, like, if you wanted a stem cell to become bone or muscle, if you put pressure on it and it feels mechanical load, it's more likely to become a muscle or bone. So they're learning those types of things. But the one guy that I talk about, because it's just such an amazing story in my book, and I talk about a lot of different things. I mean, there's a guy who's trying to regrow people's fingers and even regenerate entire limbs. But the thing that I actually is being used right now is it's in trials, but I also, people are using it off label. I went to a trauma clinic in Florida, is this incredible material that you put on a wound and it'll suppress scarring and it'll regenerate muscle. And it's actually also been used to regrow fingertips. And this guy, Steve Badalak at the University of Pittsburgh, he discovered it quite by accident. He wanted to, I think the body was rejecting aortic tissue in artificial hearts. It was identifying it as a foreign invader and attacking it. So he wanted to see if you took a piece of a dog's intestine and you put it in it's shaped kind of like the valve in the aorta. If you put that there, would it actually hold? Because the body wouldn't attack it because it's from a different part of the body. So he put that in a dog and he thought the dog would bleed out, but the dog was fine. And then eventually he went in and when he went in to see what had happened, he couldn't even find the intestine. It had changed into aorta. And he thought, what is going on here? And what he, through a number of many years, I can't tell you the whole story now, but he basically discovered that there are these, you know, what happens is the body begins to break down, or as that tissue begins to break down, it releases tiny little molecules that send signals to the body saying, A, don't cover this over with scars. And so it suppresses the normal scarring response. And B, it sends signals saying, hey, stem cells, come here and rebuild this. And so it's like a signaling agent. So if you put that on a wound, they found, if you put that on the tip of a fingertip, when you sever the fingertip, it can grow back the finger, which is pretty amazing. Wow. And also they've done experiments with people who, you know, there's a guy in my book, a large chunk of his thigh was blown off in a mortar explosion in Iraq. And normally what happens when you lose a big part of muscle is it's the priority of your body, and we've been built this way through evolution, is to just paste it over to keep out infection, you know, and that prevents it, the body, from rebuilding it. But you put this stuff in there into that part of the muscle and it suppresses the scarring response, and it actually, you can grow back a lot of that muscle that's lost. That normally you would lose so much of that, it often results in amputation. So they've actually been able to save limbs.
Keeping with the theme of movement, you have moving, sensing, and thinking. Well, hopefully, we certainly will get to sensing and thinking a little bit later in the hour. We're coming up on a break here in a minute. But to keep with movement, you one of the fun things you did here, it had to be fun, you tried a muscle suit augment your muscles. Tell us what that was and what that was like.
So a lot of these things are being used to restore lost function, but they can also be used to augment us, right? So if you understand exactly how the human leg or the different parts of the body move together, you can produce, you know, machinery that can augment that. But anyway, so I was in Japan, and this guy, he had a muscle suit, and I put it on. It was like a very light backpack, and he told me it would make me stronger. I didn't really believe him, but he had me bend down, and there was a little plastic box with 90 pounds of rice in it. And I just touched it with my fingertips, and he hit a button, and there was this hydraulic whoosh, and it lifted me up, and it was like I picked up a piece of paper.
And you had complete control of it, though.
Well, you have to hit a button, and then it'll
move you up. And so the future of this is to somehow get it wired into your brain or get your thoughts or what?
I guess you could do that, yeah. I mean, you're using an artificial power source to be able to lift things. The intent there, I mean, this is just a crude example of what it would feel like, right? I mean, they'll make it much more complicated, and you could make something like that integrated into your body. Right now, they have a huge elderly population in Japan, and they wanted to find a way to augment the muscles of caregivers who have to lift them and are always throwing out their backs, or, for example, construction workers. I think actually in the movie Aliens, the way that Sigourney Weaver defeats one of the aliens is with this huge power loader thing, right? Which is, it's just an exoskeleton that gives you extreme strength. So presumably you could just put one of these things on and it would sense when you're moving and it would move the machine and the robot along with you. It would be like having these shadow muscles and you would be able to just pick up really, really heavy things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hugh Herr has a different kind of exoskeleton, which it senses when you're moving forward and it feeds energy into your muscles so you can run for longer without using the energy in your muscles. You use a motor itself and you can run faster. And he says that, 50 years from now, when we want to visit a friend across town, we're not going to get in a huge metal box and drive there. We're just going to strap something on and just, sprint there.
Wow, that's
that's what he thinks.
Going to visit grandma, put on your exoskeleton and just run through the countryside.
Yeah.
Well, we have to go to break in just a minute. Remind us, because part of this is what we hear more and more, the CRISPR revolution. Very quickly, because I know it fits into a lot of what you're talking about. This is a revolutionary part of technology that is making a lot of this possible.
Well, that's different. I mean, that can do other stuff. So I have three chapters: bionics, regenerative medicine, and genetic engineering. And so the genetic engineering is just the in each cell of our body there's 2 billion nucleotides, which are these tiny little molecules that encode. They're like the blueprints for how you build every part of our body. And sometimes there's mutations in them or different. Different instructions. So what CRISPR does is it allows very precise editing of the genetic code.
Okay.
So you can fix things or you could upgrade it. So part of the challenge is also, we figured out how to rewrite it, but you also have to figure out how to understand it. And when you have 3 billion individual units, that's not easy. A lot of intelligence probably involves hundreds of genes. So they're trying to decode that.
Adam, we have to take a break. Please stay with us. Adam Peori, is with us, author of Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Fascinating stories to come, including the story of a woman who was blinded in an accident at a grenade factory. Now she can see with her ears. Adam will tell us that story when we come back, The Bodybuilders. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour with award-winning investigative journalist and science writer Adam Peori. His new book, Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. In it, he explores ways to help restore lost bodily function to the injured, but also, not only that, but to also unlock some new potential in the uninjured. And he's telling us stories, all of these new potentials in various areas of body function, whether it be movement or sensing or thinking, come with very interesting stories of people perhaps have been injured and have regained, come back from those limitations in very interesting ways. Adam, tell us now the story, please, of Pat Fletcher. This is a woman who was blinded. This is over 20 years ago and has a fascinating technology to help her see with her ears, so to speak. I watched the video on your website here. It's quite interesting. Tell us first how she was injured.
Right. So, Pat was, I think she wanted to be a veterinarian. And she also loved nature. She loved to hike and look at mountains. And So to raise money to go to veterinarian school, she got a job working in a factory that made grenades. And I guess there was some sort of container was not properly cleaned out, and there was a chemical reaction. The last thing she remembers is she was holding a hose, and she actually saw this barrel of chemicals begin to bulge outward, and she felt the hose get really hot, and then there was this blinding explosion. And when she woke up, she was, you know, one of her eyeballs was gone, the other was permanently shut. And so there, these chemicals reacted and exploded, and she was blinded permanently. So she never went to veterinarian school, obviously. And she learned to live with it and you know, had a seeing eye cane and dog. And one day, many years later, she still liked to match her clothes. And she had a program on the internet that responded to voice commands and translated text into voice. And so she was looking for a program. She wanted to be able to point a camera at her clothes and somehow have it tell her what color they were so she could color coordinate. And she came across this program, and it also claimed to be able to convert pictures into sounds that you could allow you to see with your ears, which she thought sounded ridiculous. And it turned out that this program had been designed by this Dutch engineer, and it's sort of like they call it a reverse spectrogram. I'll tell you what that is in a sec. But anyway, she played these sounds. They're called soundscapes. And she thought it sounded crazy until she heard one of a fence with a gate that opened. And something about the sound, she could actually see this gate opening in her mind's eye, and it blew her mind. And so now what this is, the way this works is that what this Dutch engineer discovered is that, and I guess it's known that our brain is capable of discerning between 30 and 100 tones simultaneously, right? So what this program does is it takes a picture, and it takes a pixel, and all the pixels, and the lower down the pixel is on the picture, you know, in the column, the lower the tone. The higher up it is, the higher the tone. The brighter the pixel, the louder the tone. And what it does is it scans across a picture, and it spits out these tones that translate the pixels into a consistent pattern of tones, like so about 100 at the same time, and our brain can actually make sense of this.
After a while, we have to say, if you or I would put it on, we would not immediately make sense of it. Is that right?
Well, you can make sense of it a little bit. She immediately understood that there was a gate there, and the metaphor I like to use to explain this is think about this. The world of a blind person has been described as often profoundly claustrophobic, right? The only thing you can feel is what you can touch in front of you. But when it rains, you all of a sudden gain depth perception because and a sense of the world out there because the blind people can hear the raindrops hitting, you know, the rocks in the distance. And so the world kind of expands when it rains. And so we get a little bit of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the different volume of the different tones, but what it turned, there's this famous guy named Paul Baccarita who's died now, but he's a pioneer in a field called sensory substitution. And what he always said is that we see with the brain, not with the eyes. And what that means is, in the same way I was saying before, they can control a prosthetic, a robot, if they can just get the signals out of the motor cortex. And so if you can just get the signals from the outside world into the visual cortex, then your brain can make sense of that. So now what happened is, and the brain is an amazing pattern recognition machine, and over time it does adjust and it does learn to associate different patterns with things in the outside world.
Mm.
So what happened is Pat Fletcher, she eventually got a camera and she put it on a hat and she had a laptop and she started using this program and she was able to see patterns on the wall and she was able to look at leaves outside and she could her brain could kind of make sense of this. And the more she used it, the better it got at it, until one day she was looking in the sink and she regained depth perception. Now, all of this sounds dubious, but word got out, and she was actually these neuroscientists who study this phenomenon, which is called neuroplasticity. It's the ability of the brain to adjust and to make sense of things and rewire itself. They had her in and to scan her brain. And when they jingled keys next to her ear, those sounds were routed to the auditory processing areas of the brain. But when they actually played the soundscapes for her, her brain routed it to the visual processing areas of the brain.
Wow.
Quite remarkable. So her brain had actually recognized these as vision, and she actually was experiencing something like vision. So now this has been seen before in the cochlear implant, if you've heard of that, when they basically, the way we get sound to the brain from the ear is there are these, you know, it creates, these tiny little hairs are moved by the vibrations of sound, and it sends a pattern of electrical signals to the brain. And when those break, we lose our ability to hear as well. The cochlear implant tried to replicate that by sending patterns of shocks. And, you know, it was much cruder than the real thing. And one of the guys I talked to in the book, a guy named Mike Merzenich, who helped pioneer the cochlear implant, he said it's kind of like trying to play the piano with your forearms. But they put the initial cochlear implants in people who had trouble hearing, and the people came back and said, this is garbage, I don't understand anything. But they kept the cochlear implants in there, and after about 6 months, something amazing started happening. Their brains had rewired themselves, and these people came in and they started saying, I understand everything now, I can hear again.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, so it's similar with what Pat is using. And when I tell the story, I like to tell the story about how she loved nature and she couldn't look at it anymore. And one day she was at a conference in I think Arizona or New Mexico with the guy who invented this thing, and they were standing out in the desert and they were looking out, and she was describing to him what she saw, and she said, that's a cactus, and that's, you know, looks like a car over there. And then she said to him, Peter, what are those triangles in the distance? And he said, you can see those? Those are mountains. And she started to cry because she could see, you know, the first time she'd seen mountains. So, you know, I always love those stories of people like, you know, Hugh, her running again, her seeing nature again.
Right.
You know, you can live a very satisfying life without, when you lose these things. But sometimes there's things in particular that we miss when we lose the ability to interact with the world in the ways that we were born with.
If you've just joined us, talking with the author of The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human, Adam Peori is with us for the entire hour. We're winding up the hour, a little over 10 minutes left. I'm looking at my notes, so many things I wanted to talk with you about. Adam, I see we won't get to all of them. Let's go to some of the thinking ones. What's really interesting here is you explore in your book a new effort by the military to reverse engineer human intuition. Now, right. That seems like an impossible task to engineer the ability to understand something immediately without sort of reasoning it through. And this has military applications. So tell us that story and who's working on it.
Right. So the military started noticing people were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they would say, you know, consistently, a lot of people would say, you know, there's one guy in my unit, and he always seemed to know when something was wrong. You know, we always wanted him out on patrol. He would say, you know, get down, something's wrong. Or there was a guy in my convoy, and he would say, something's not right here, stop the convoy. And he couldn't say what was wrong, but when they went out and would look, sure enough, they would find a hidden IED. And so but this is not a phenomenon. This phenomenon has actually been heard before. I mean, I had heard it when I think about it. You always hear about the seasoned Vietnam vet who stops, you know, right before an ambush because he senses something.
Right.
So scientists have known for a while that we pick up on subtle cues outside of our awareness. You know, the best example of this and the way that we understand it the most is through studying amnesiacs, because amnesiacs don't remember. They've lost their ability to form explicit memories, but they started noticing that, for instance, even somebody who doesn't remember yesterday can learn how to walk home. And a famous example is there's this doctor. He would meet the same amnesiac woman every morning, and she never remembered meeting him. And every morning he would reintroduce himself, and it was like they were meeting for the first time. So one day he put a pin in the palm of his hand, and he said, how do you do? And he shook her hand and stuck her with the pin, and she said, ouch. And the next day she didn't remember meeting him and when he introduced himself again, but she wouldn't shake his hand. So what they've actually, and so some people have studied this, and there's a scientist at Northwestern that I spoke to who's very involved in this military intuition project. And basically there was this commander in the Pentagon who was, you know, down south one time at a base, and somebody was telling him about this guy who had patrol, and he's like, can you make us all like that, you know, who everybody wanted on patrol because he had this intuition, can you train us to do that? So he began looking at ways to do this, and one of the people who studied this is a guy named Paul Reber at Northwestern, And what Paul Reber has found is that, you know, when you think about it, everybody knows we have motor memory, right? You learn to ride a bike, and that's something you just know how to do unconsciously. Sometimes you might be driving home and you don't remember getting into your driveway, but you've driven it so much, you know how to get there.
Right.
And it turns out that we have the same part of the brain that gives us motor memory also gives us perceptual memory. You know, we can get perceptual expertise. And so there's two forms of learning. There's explicit learning, the things we explicitly know, and implicit learning. And so, you know, we can learn things that aren't correct. And that's how we can make assumptions that are, you know, catastrophic. But if you train a soldier with enough times, and they're trying to come up with these video simulations of, you know, where somebody can just see, if they've seen enough pictures where there's something that's associated with a IED or something, then you can start to recognize that if you're open to it.
So it's a matter of just training them visually, not to use any technology on the brain, or you talk about, I think, recognizing a neural signature of intuition.
Right. Yeah. So you can accelerate this, and again, it's utilizing that same thing that is being used to help Pat Fletcher, which is just that the brain is this amazing pattern recognition machine, you know. But you're training it to recognize patterns in a different way. And so, you can accelerate the training and see if the training's working by looking for this neural signature of intuition. And what they did is to get funding for this, the person who came up with this in the Pentagon first had to show that they weren't crazy, that something actually existed. And so they elicited the intuition effect in patients, and they looked for a neurosignature that was associated with it. So I'm not expressing this in a great way, but they took all these pictures, right? Like a picture of a bed or a picture of a cup, and they removed a lot of pixels from it so that you couldn't really tell what it was, you know, even consciously. But somehow, if you just guessed based on a feeling, sometimes you got it right. And so they showed people pictures of a cup with just a few pieces of a cup. And then they showed them pictures of pixels that were scrambled that weren't anything. And they found a neural signature, you know, a specific pattern of firing in the brain that was associated with getting it right and guessing that there was something there, showing that people knew that they knew something was there even though they didn't know they knew, if that makes sense.
Right.
You can monitor that when you're training people with these,
Yeah. One other thinking process I wanted you to get to before the hour ends. We have about 5 minutes left. Adam, tell us quickly, since we mentioned it earlier in the hour, about what has been called Viagra for the brain and about how this may help those suffering from age-related memory loss or also improve the memory in people who don't have memory loss.
Right. Well, yeah. So there's a company in San Diego called Dart Pharmaceuticals, funded by this heir to the Styrofoam empire called Dart Styrofoam, a guy named Kenneth Dart, and it's a guy who's a very well-respected memory researcher, and they're looking for drugs that can give us all a memorization pill, basically, that you could take it and you could memorize things very quickly. And one of the ways they're doing this is they've started a worldwide search for people with exceptional memory. They sponsor actually a tournament every year for so-called memory athletes so that the best memory people will come and compete to win, and then they're scanning their brains. And they're also, this guy, the scientist who runs this thing, a guy named Tim Tully, has actually found genes that he can turn on and off that give fruit flies the equivalent of photographic memories. And they have, I think, three drugs in the pipeline right now in different stages of trials.
It's interesting, too, you bring out in your book, too, I don't know how related this is, about this savant, Derek Amato, and his story tells us through a concussion that there's a lot stored in our brain that we might not know about or we can't access, but it doesn't mean it isn't there.
Right, exactly. Different pattern. Well, so in my chapter about creativity, what they found is that there's actually there's a part of the brain that's very analytical, and that if you actually, and it exerts an inhibitory effect on the on parts of our brain that are involved in creativity. And people who've had damage to the area of the brain that's exerting this inhibitory effect actually exhibit some creativity. So the most famous case is there are these elderly patients that have a specific form of frontotemporal dementia. And as they start, as the parts of the brain that are involved in reasoning, you know, some of these guys, they start to take off their clothes in parking lots, yell at people, exhibit inappropriate behavior, and can't find the words to speak, but they develop these exquisite painting abilities, right? And or musical abilities. And this is called, and it's because this part of the brain that also is often overdeveloped in autistic savants is being loosened up and allowed to operate unchecked. And they've actually, you know, that's one of the this abnormalities in the area, this area are also associated with certain mental diseases, you know, like bipolar disorder. And that's why you see a correlation between that and creativity. And with Derek Amato, he was able to, he banged his head diving into a pool, got a concussion, which was, and, you know, confirmed by the Mayo Clinic, this brain damage, and then suddenly he could play the piano, which is kind of almost implausible. But you know, I heard him play, and everybody says he couldn't play before.
Uh-huh.
So I was trying to poke holes in the story.
We have a couple minutes before we go. Talk quickly about the ethics that you ran into here, and whether writing and researching this book left you feeling more like our future of all this new technology is more utopian or dystopian?
Well, you know, that's part of part of what motivated me to write this book is that I read all these dystopian predictions about how terrible things will be, but I could never really get a sense of how realistic they were. And I kept reading that we're going to do this and that, and I said, that's possible. So I started looking at these things. I wanted to understand how the human body and mind work and how the science works so I could really evaluate what is possible and what isn't possible, you know? And all the ethical concerns that people bring up are often vague, and there's, you know, it's really hard to get your arms around what is actually going to happen and what's possible. So I wanted to have sort of a guide of what's possible so we could evaluate these claims, and I tried to deal with ethics throughout the book. But, you know, as a military scientist said to me, I said, are these technologies good, a good thing or a bad thing? Should we be happy about them or scared? And he said, well, it depends. You know, is a baseball bat a good thing or a bad thing? It's a good thing if you use it to play baseball. It's a bad thing if you use it to, you know, beat somebody over the head with. And that's the way it is with a lot of these technologies. And what I came to realize is that more often, these technologies, and I mean, these could be used to augment and upgrade us, but they're also what's driving this revolution right now is the desire to help people who have lost something, you know, to help them get back things that are, you know, would improve the quality of their life. And most of this research is being funded to help people who've been hurt in war. And so, yeah, it could be used for bad things, but over and over again, I came across these inspiring stories, and I wrote about people. You know, I talked a lot about the science here, but really at the heart of my book, I tried to write it so that people could get lost in it and forget that they're reading about science because they're reading about people and people getting back things they lost. And so I came away very positive. You know, I mean, we already have the capacity to vaporize each other with the touch of a button. You know, we can already nuke each other into oblivion or... You know, we have terrible bioweapons. So, yes, some of these technologies could also be used to build horrible RoboCop-type robots that could destroy us or genetically engineer a super race. And certainly we need to talk about those problems, but, you know, genetic engineering and stuff is being used. That's the most problematic and dangerous of these technologies, I think. It's being used to you know, save people with devastating genetic...
Right. Adam, before we go, I wonder, in writing this book, have you considered which of these augmented abilities you explore in the book you would most like to have if someone would offer you one?
Well, yeah, the memorization pill sounds kind of nice.
It does. You know? It does.
How about? I mean, because that's just a pill that would have been good in college, you know.
Okay, I'll pick the exoskeleton that has me running across the countryside like a cheetah without becoming tired.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's pretty cool, too. Definitely.
Adam Peery, thank you for joining us this hour. Author of The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Fascinating. We only got to a fraction of the stories you have here, the technologies that you explore, Adam. But it's been wonderful spending the hour with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help today from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Perhaps you have a suggestion for a theme for an upcoming talk show. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Remember, tomorrow, Politics Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield joining us, I believe. Also, Tim Hagel. We hope you'll join us with your comments and questions, the latest on the political landscape. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talk to you again tomorrow.